From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Emeryville.
I live in Antioch, California.
Potter's Creek.
Pleasant Hill.
I live in Albany, but Albany doesn't have neighborhoods.
Coming up, we confront what it really takes to make your chicken dinner.
I eat meat, and I'm not going to pretend that someone didn't kill that animal for me.
Then urban farmer and writer Novella Carpenter talks about raising animals in her Oakland backyard, from chickens to goats to rabbits.
I can't imagine a cow working out in the city. They're just too big. But I think probably you could do sheep.
And we'll hear from a local author about a book she says made the rest of the world fall away.
One day I was in the bookstore, and I just thought, what the hell? Let me just try it out. And I was captivated.
You'll be captivated too by today's Cross Currents. Death is a scary and mysterious reality for most people, but we encounter it every time we eat meat. In this piece, KALW's Ted Muldoon takes us to an unlikely place to confront the reality of meat production. A neighbor's backyard. And a note to our listeners, this story does get a little graphic.
I killed my first deer in the backwoods of Wisconsin when I was 13. This was the first time I really understood the existential price of eating meat, which is death. I continued hunting throughout my childhood and until present day. But when I moved to the Bay Area about a year ago, I discovered that culturally, many people here are not okay with killing animals. This is a story about how our relationship with meat affects our relationship with death. And it begins in a preschool. We've probably all heard children play games like this.
I'm gonna kill you, you're dead now!
This animal's dead, I'm gonna bury her now. This toy cow, I'm gonna eat it, I'm gonna kill it and eat it.
Basically, like, pretend play about death. For many parents, death is a very uncomfortable subject to hear their children playing around with.
They don't even know what they're talking about, but really, they're just trying to figure out, like, what is this death thing that everybody talks about?
This is Rachel Soroka.
Hi, I'm Rachel Soroka.
Soroka has a 5-year-old daughter named...
Shireen.
Shireen is an adorable coiled spring of enthusiasm and curiosity.
I'm a kind of bird. I'm a harpy eagle.
A harpy eagle?
Claws! 3 feet long.
3 feet long claws?
Yeah.
What? No way.
Yes.
Soroka is doing something unusual to tackle her parental discomfort with death.
So we had this like meeting at my preschool, and we were talking about how interested our kids are in death and how uncomfortable we all are with trying to talk to them about it, because it's horrifying for most people, I think. Like, I'm gonna die, you're gonna die, we're all gonna die. Like, yuck.
Soroka suggested an unobvious solution.
I'm a proponent of knowing the truth for kids. And I'm like, why not show them what it really is? And I'm like, hey, you know, one thing that's been really interesting for me is to kill some chickens and know what death is for real, like look it in the face. And so if anybody ever wants to bring your kids and come over and, you know, when I'm harvesting chickens, I'd be happy to, you know, include you guys in that. And the room was like quiet. And then like one mom was like, yeah, I'm in. And then another one was like, that's interesting. And then a bunch of other people looked at each other like, oh my God, that's horrifying. And that's cool. Like, that totally makes sense because it's a ridiculous suggestion. But I thought it would be a really interesting class to sort of go into the horror that we all experience around death rather than sort of keep hiding from it.
Soroka's class is sort of an ethical thought experiment. It forces the question, what would the average American's relationship with death be like if we killed as many animals as we consumed?
I eat meat, and I'm not going to pretend that someone didn't kill that animal for me.
Which gets at my point. So many of us have confused feelings about being a carnivore. Last year, Americans slaughtered 2 million sheep, 30 million cows, 106 million pigs, 8.6 billion chickens. 8.6 billion. That's a full billion more than there are humans on the planet, killed in just 1 year in the United States alone. Voracious. And yet, urban meat eaters don't really want to think about where their meat comes from. What's weird about this is that a majority, like 90% of Americans, will eat a turkey sandwich or what have you for lunch like no one's business. But But if you asked them if they could kill that turkey, an unavoidable precondition to its sandwichization, urban carnivores get uncomfortable. Soroka's class has the potential to repair this disconnect. Which brings us to Soroka's backyard in Richmond.
My backyard is a bit of a jungle. I have probably a dozen fruit trees back here. And then the back corner of my yard is fenced off for my chickens, my laying hens.
Soroka started raising hens about 5 years ago. She's currently using a retrofitted children's play castle as a roost.
That is an egg-laying cluck.
Some breeds of chicken average laying more eggs than others. Prodigious breeds can pump out around 5 eggs a week, while others may lay just one. But when they begin to stop laying eggs altogether,
you have to do something with them. And you could just keep them as pets and let them like live out their non-egg laying days. Or what I do is I kill them and eat them.
How many classes have you had?
One, two, three, four. Four so far.
I joined Soroka for her fifth class at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning.
Who's going to be joining us in your backyard?
We have 7 chickens as our unwilling participants in the day, because nothing really likes dying, I've noticed. Imagine that. And we have a couple families. Some people are arriving right now. Hello. How's it going?
Hi. I'm Megan.
I'm Rachel.
I'm Lucas from the
Lucas,
store.
Lucas, yeah, totally. Yeah. Hi, it's great
Hi.
To have you.
Nice to meet you.
You guys killed chickens before?
No.
There's about 11 of us all together.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi. 8 adults.
Hello. You guys say hi?
Hi.
And 3 kids.
So let's all meet over here.
Soroka picks out a chicken and leads us over to one of her raised gardening beds, where she perches on the side as the rest of us huddle around.
Do you guys want to meet a chicken?
Okay.
She's called a Rhode Island red chicken. Do you want to touch her feathers?
Hi, pretty girl. What do you think she's saying? Where are my friends?
There's a weird mixture of unease, anticipation, and warmth. Most of the people in attendance have not seen an animal killed before, but Soroka still manages to bring a sense of calm.
Sometimes it's nice to say thank you to the chicken.
At this point, the hen is tightly swaddled in Soroka's black apron, rolled over on its back, bundled and nestled into Soroka's lap. Soroka takes the time to explain how she's going to kill the chicken. She demonstrates.
So right behind her little chicken ear here is where we're going to cut.
Even though I've seen and personally killed animals before, the anticipation at the scene is thick. It's impossible to distance yourself from the weight of the situation.
I stretch her neck out just a little bit.
And then the moment comes.
And I cut down and let the blood out.
This is easily the most difficult part to watch.
So what we're going to do is we'll take turns. So 2 people can go at once.
We move along in pairs. First up is Marie, mother of 2 kids in attendance today. Her daughters are captivated as they grimace and squirm in their seat. But as soon as it's over, without skipping a beat, they run off to play with Soroka's daughter, Shireen. Marie goes to talk to her daughters afterwards, and I asked what they said.
She just asked me kind of in the corner. She's like, what did it feel like? So I think slowly they'll have more questions, perhaps.
Yeah. Immediate reactions are pretty similar.
You know, it was easier than I thought it would be, actually. I think the hardest part was, like, knowing where the right spot is a little bit stressful.
I end up being the last to take a turn, and I'm left with what is easily the most interesting-looking chicken of the lot.
Is that natural?
It smells so cool.
Yeah. She's black with huge plumage that encases her neck like a lion's mane.
Her name's Tiny.
Oh,
Tiny.
The only one that's got a name.
This is a very intimate way to kill an animal. And there's a striking sense of ceremony about it, too. I tightly wrap Tiny in my apron and settle her into my lap. Soroka delivers some final instructions as I position my knife along Tiny's throat. I can't entirely hide the tremble of my hand.
It's a good grip, and a perfect cut is waiting for you right there.
It's been a while since I've killed anything.
Decisively done, yes. Very good. And so to break her neck, you'll pull back across your thumb and push down toward the ground.
Should I pull back towards me?
Pull back, like, this way. There you go. Yeah.
Tiny's body starts to take sweeping kicks, but she's bundled tightly enough in my apron that I can control her body's convulsions. It doesn't take long for her to unwind in my hands.
So Tiny is now lifeless. So we'll go lay Tiny down with the rest of them?
Yeah, please. Great.
And just like that, it's over.
We have now killed all our chickens.
And we move on.
We're ready to pluck.
The rest of the class plays out like a high school biology lab in dissection and anatomy. We dunk the chicken carcasses in scalding water to loosen its feathers for plucking. There's dismembering and disemboweling. One certain takeaway?
Yes.
Bodies are cool.
You have a laying hen there.
Wow.
Cut through it, and then you can open it up, and you'll see inside everything she was eating.
As we wrap up, Soroka takes a poll.
So I'm curious if anybody has anything that was like surprising or interesting, or like what moved you about doing this? Probably something.
Soroka says that since she's started teaching the class, just after the chickens were killed,
kids would watch and kind of be like, whoa. And they would touch it while it was dead and be like, wow, 1 minute it's alive and 1 minute it's dead. Like, what's that about? And then they'd go climb trees and run around my backyard and play with my cat. And, you know, they were unfazed, fascinated and really awed by it, but unfazed.
Since taking her class, I've seen my own diet change. I eat meat much more liberally than I did before. How do I explain this change in my behavior? Well, it's hard to say, but perhaps because it left me feeling more connected to the meat I consume, if only by proxy.
Feel a little sorry, yeah, I do. And then I also feel just super grateful when I'm eating them. I know what it means to have a chicken on my plate.
I believe my childhood experiences hunting have shaped the way I see death in my adult years. In a way, I think death is more familiar to me than it is for those who have not killed their own meat. It's something I've directly confronted, brought about even. And as for the kids at today's class, death doesn't seem to be all that scary to them either. At least not yet. By the end, they've already moved on to more important things.
You're pretty high up in that tree there.
Yeah, I can get down.
You got good balance. Have you done this class before?
Yeah.
Yeah? How do you like it?
Good. I'm gonna take off my shoes.
For Cross Currents, I'm Ted Muldoon.
That story originally aired, Rachel Soroka has moved from the Bay Area, so you can't enroll your preschooler in her class, but maybe you can start your own in your backyard. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we'll head to another East Bay yard where urban farmer Novella Carpenter is raising rabbits, chickens, and goats right in the middle of Oakland's Ghost Town neighborhood. She blogs about it at Ghost Town Farm, and she wrote about it in her book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. KALW's Ben Treffney sat down with Novella Carpenter to ask her how exactly it all works.
Well, basically, it's two parts. There's one, which is the vegetable garden, which is on this, it's 4,500 square feet. So it's the same size as a house, like a lot that a house would normally be on. That is filled with vegetables and fruit trees. And then in the backyard, I have my goats in the back and the chickens. So there's a chicken house and a goat shed. And
how many goats and chickens do you have?
There's six goats. There's two moms and four babies. And then there's six chickens. And then on our deck, which is a very shady sort of windy area, is where we keep the rabbits. Rabbits hate to be overheated, so we keep them out on the front deck.
And how many rabbits do you have right
there
now?
There are 15 at this moment.
Uh-huh. Mm. Or 16, maybe.
I know, they breed like rabbits. So.
Could you have cows if you wanted to? Is that allowed
in Oakland? I think that would definitely be looked down upon. I can't imagine a cow working out in the city. They're just too big. They're kind of cumbersome. I'm not sure if I could actually get enough food to them. But I think probably you could do sheep. You know, you could have sheep that go around and mow people's lawns.
Sure.
I mean, for instance, in the White House, I can't remember what year, they had sheep that mowed the White House lawn. Oh. I mean, it is something that used to happen. We've just forgotten.
Are these legal by zoning requirements in the city? I mean, if you want to have an urban farm and have it fully outfitted with livestock, then what can you have and what are you limited to?
It depends on which city you live in. Mm-hmm. So I can't remember. San Francisco definitely has like more strict laws than, say, Oakland. So you really just have to check your local city ordinance.
I understand that you actually share notes on goats with your local liquor store owner.
I do. There's a guy named Mossed who owns Brothers Market, which is about half a block away from my house. And he's from Yemen, and he was a goat farmer before he moved to America to become a liquor store owner. And he's a fount of knowledge, goat knowledge. So he's able to tell me different things about how to feed them. He also kept bees, so he has many opinions about bees. Keeping. So it's pretty normal for me just to bring one of my goats over to the liquor store.
Just walk it down the street.
Just walk it down the street. I brought Hedwig, one of our goats, over the other day just to have him look at her and see if she's okay. And so that's great. That's really great. And like, I think there's also this sort of attitude, like this is just like a hippie white thing to do, but it's actually not. It's very multi-ethnic. There's all these people with all this information that want to share it, but nobody to tell it to.
So what have you learned then by running an urban farm?
What I learned is that there's no money in farming. It's really hard to make ends meet. It's kind of made me very poor because I have to feed the animals first. It's kind of like having kids, I think. You always want to make sure that the animals are fine and fed and in cages or in their proper environment. That requires some money. I don't know that I'm necessarily like a total advocate. You know, I feel like, of course, it's only something that you should do if you want to do it. I think people sometimes feel like, oh, this is a trendy thing and I should do it. But I know that it's a lot of work and that it isn't right for a lot of people. Like a lot of people, you know, people ask me like, I want to get goats. And I'm just like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Do you know how much work it is? Do you know how much time you're going to be, you know, spending with these animals? And so I'm not necessarily advocating that. I mean, mostly I'm just telling a story, you know, about my experiences because hopefully people will learn. It's not like it's just always a bright and happy story. You know, there's definitely downsides of the farm and bad things happen. And I sort of wanted to show the spectrum of what can happen if you do this thing, urban farming.
That was writer and urban farmer Novella Carpenter. She spoke with KLW's Ben Trefney. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now it's time for the book report brought to you by the Litography Project.
Ah, the Litography Project!
Shh. Your guide to the literary Bay Area.
For the book report, we ask Bay Area writers to tell us about a book that's meaningful for them. Today we hear from Natalie Bazile, a writer living in San Francisco.
My name is Natalie Bazile, and my book report is about Amy Bloom's novel, Away. And it's the story of Lillian Leib, this Jewish immigrant, who comes to New York after having escaped the Russian pogroms. And she comes here to make a new life for herself, but she's also haunted by the fact that her whole family has been killed. A relative appears and reveals that her daughter is in fact alive. And so Lillian embarks on this journey that takes her across the continental United States and then up through the Alaskan Yukon as she's trying to walk back to Russia to find her daughter. I probably circled around this book for a year. And then one day I was in the bookstore and I just thought, what the hell? Let me just try it out. And I was captivated. I savored it. Away is just beautifully written. I mean, the sentences are gorgeous. There's a flow and a rhythm to the language that I loved. The scene that I'm going to read is the moment when Lillian is saying goodbye to Yaakov. Yaakov is an older Jewish guy who has been kind of like a father figure to her in the book. And they just love each other dearly, not romantically, but just almost as family. And Yakov has had his own tragedies and his own heartbreak and sadness. And in this scene, in this paragraph, he is putting Lillian on the train. And she's going to take that train from New York to Seattle and embark on the second half of her journey, which is to find her daughter.
Lillian and Yakov look at each other, and O'Brien checks his watch. Yakov picks up his empty glass. He could smash it into pieces and write Lillian's name on his chest. He puts the glass down. It's not necessary. Her name is already there. Yakov holds Lillian to him so hard, the four buttons of his overcoat press through her sweater and her blouse and her camisole into her skin, and she clasps her hands around the back of his thin neck as if he were her father. Zeguvnet, hey, Lillian says. Go with God, and she means go with my love. She means come with me. She means do not leave me. She means I cannot do this without you. She means do not let me go.
It's such a rich story. The rest of the world falls away and you're in this other place. And that's what I like about books. I like it when, you know, the world that the author has created is its own particular universe.
Natalie Bazille's debut novel, Queen Sugar, about a black woman who inherits a sugar plantation in Louisiana, was released in paperback. It's also being adapted into a TV series by writer-director Ava DuVernay and co-produced by Oprah Winfrey. This book report was produced by Hannah Kingsley Ma for The Litography Project. And if you've got a story you want to tell us about, email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. You can also give us a call. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Olivia Cueva, Rachel Dornhelm, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, Todd Whitney, and Liza Veal. Seth Samuel engineered today's show. The line producer was Audrey Dilling. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.